I think I'm going to like majoring in history, said the student who was home this summer from college. Good, I said. It was tough at first, he said. The reading, I asked. The reading list can be long with a history major. No, that's not what was tough, he said. The first thing you've got to do in order to major in history is to become an atheist. After that, everything's easier. What? Yeah, you find out early in exams that the answers to questions like, what was a major cause of the Civil War? Or what factor contributed to the Great Depression is never God. You can't say there was a civil war between the states because America practiced slavery and God wanted a war between the states, or in the Great Depression, God was trying to teach us a lesson. The right answer is never God. You see, modernity has devised a closed system of knowing. All knowledge must be self-derived, readily available to anyone using methods of empiricism. And it's proved to be remarkably fruitful, that way of apprehending the world. That means of reassuring us that the world is our world. When everything that we know about the world exclusively arises from within our world, we can run the world fairly much as we please. And of course, the bloody, malevolent 20th century is the result, which I think goes a long way to explaining why you don't get much God in modernity. That classic of a generation ago, Rabbi Kushner's When Bad Things Happen to Good People, speaks of a God who cares but doesn't actually do anything. Empathetic, loving, but uninvolved. Deism, stoicism, that's about as much God as you and I can handle. Any more God might threaten our stable arrangements that make us think we're in control. Now, I say all of this to indicate why we have such terrible difficulty understanding the parables that Jesus tells us. It's not because we are sophisticated, critical, early 21st century people. It's because we live in a hermetically sealed, flat, predictable world where the only actions are ours and the only future is the one constructed by and for us. The sociologist Charles Murray is told of being approached by a few 20-something members of the audience after a lecture he gave on the well-lived life in Zurich, Switzerland, a couple of years ago. And they plainly said to him that the phrase, the well-lived life, didn't have any meaning for them. They were having a great time with their current sex partner, a new BMW, and the vacation home in Mallorca. They saw no voids in their life that needed filling. And so Jesus is to us sometimes incomprehensible. Not because he is primitive and pre-scientific, but rather because Jesus renders a world quite different from the world we live in. In this morning's gospel, when some religious folk grumble because this man receives sinners and eats with them, Jesus tells some stories to explain himself. Which of you, having 100 sheep and one strays, will not leave the 99 and wander off in the wilderness in order to search for the one lost sheep? And when you find that sheep, which one of you will not place that sheep on your shoulders and return home, where you will find considerably fewer sheep than when you left, and say to your friends, I found my sheep, let's party. Now, which of you would do that? Which one of you women, when you have lost a quarter, will move all your furniture out on the front lawn, rip up the carpet, move out the heavy appliances into the yard, and when you've found that lost coin, run out and shout to the neighbors, you're all invited to a party such as St. Louis has never seen, I found my quarter. Which one of you would do that? I think we know the answer. None of us would do that. None of us would do that because we are balanced, rational people with a sense of propriety and proportion. The parties next door on the campus of WashU, they are for the purposes of getting wasted on Saturday night in order to anesthetize, not over something so insignificant as one lost sheep or a lost coin. In Douglas Copeland's novel, Life After God, one of the characters speaks with one of his adult friends, and he says, "I know you guys think my life is some big joke, that it's going nowhere, but I'm happy. And it's not like I'm lost or anything. We're all too middle class ever to be lost. Lost means you had faith or something to begin with, and the middle class never really had any of that. So we can never be lost. And you tell me, Scout, what is it we end up with being then? What exactly is it we end up being then instead of lost?" But in Jesus' parable, we're not hearing a story about us or about some new program or project for betterment, some political program. We are hearing a story about God. A God who throws a party in heavens, but only for sinners, only for the lost. The main requirement for being found by Jesus is to be lost. Jesus told these outrageous little stories about God, who grumbled, to those who grumbled, because of the unsavory company he kept. But I think our grumbling against Jesus has a different source. How do we like this God who won't stay where we've put him? This God who relentlessly reaches out and intrudes and seeks and saves? It's tough to be on the receiving end of love, God's love or anybody else's. It requires that we see our lives not as possessions, but as gifts. "Nothing is more repugnant to capable, reasonable people than grace," wrote John Wesley a long time ago. We enjoy thinking of ourselves as the chief actors in the business between us and God. "I'm searching for something spiritual in my life," we say. "I've been experimenting with various forms of spirituality," we say. "I've decided to give my life to Jesus," we say. Modernity has convinced us that our lives are our own, that we are the authors of our fate, that we are the captains of our souls. Yet Jesus, whether he's telling a parable or being born of a virgin or dying on the cross or rising from the grave, is continually portraying a God who loves us so much that he cannot leave us to our own devices. This is a God who will not stay where we put him. Are you willing to be loved by that much of a God? Someone asked me a while back, "What proof do you have that Easter's true, that Jesus really rose from the dead?" And I responded in all seriousness, "Well, my main proof right now is that two or three parishioners I know who are successful, self-made, prosperous, self-confident, well-fixed types give away 10% of what they make every year. And they're Episcopalians. Now, how do you explain that? I have no other explanation for that other than that Jesus really rose from the dead and he's loose in our world. This is a God who will not leave us alone, who will not leave us where he finds us. This past Easter, at the vigil, I met a man who wanted to be baptized. "How did you come to church?" I asked him. "What brought you here?" "I got put here," he said. "That I'm here tonight planning to be baptized is nothing short of a miracle. I really mean it. I think Jesus just came out and got me." Amen.